Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Quoting Eric Hoffer, an American philosopher and social critic with a working-class background, quote, "Man is eminently a storyteller, his search for a purpose, a cause, an ideal, and a mission, and the like, is largely a search for a plot and a pattern in the development of his life story, a story that is basically without meaning or pattern," unquote. Well, my guest today is a storyteller, but also a man with a purpose, a cause, an ideal, and a mission. Filmmaker, philanthropist Peter Samuelson is author of Finding Happy. It's a user's guide to your life with lessons from mine. Published by Regalo Press and distributed by Simon & Schuster and available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Peter, go to samuelson.la, samuelson.la. Follow him on Facebook and X. And Peter, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm so happy to be with you. Hello, and, bagels.
Yes, we all love bagels. You know what? It's part of why I'm happy.
Indeed. The other thing is people don't realize that the invention and the propagation of bagels is one of the great economic victories of all time, because not only are you selling the bread, but you're selling the hole in the middle, which didn't cost you anything.
And that's the whole story. Exactly.
Holier than thou.
Exactly. I wanted to quote a little bit from your book. It's called Finding Happy, User's Guide to Your Life with Lessons from Mine. And the new revised version will have a chapter on bagels, I'm sure. And here is my quote, and this is from you. And that, my dears, is the closest I can get to telling you the meaning of life. And if not every life, then for sure mine. You raise your kids. By a miracle, they turn out fine despite all your mistakes. You love your wife and friends. You do random acts of kindness. And then you die. That's the best deal we can get. And it's pretty wonderful. Unquote. That's a lot in one paragraph. But it cuts to the core, doesn't it?
I think so. Actually, in the book, we have three chapters that are peppered into it, the meaning of life part one, the meaning of life part two, and finally the meaning of life part three. And none of them are the Monty Python version.
What brought you to write this book? And I might want to mention to our listeners and viewers that your chapters are mercifully short. And when I say that, it's not an insult to you. It's actually an aid to the reader, because you can digest nuggets at your own pace, and you can pick and choose. And as you say in your book, you don't have to start with chapter one. You can go to chapter 20 and then work your way back or forward. Well, however you want to do it.
Yes, indeed. I started by realizing that one of the seven charities of which I am blessedly the founder, First Star, where we house, educate, and encourage teenage foster kids with the goal of helping them, despite the abuse and neglect in their backgrounds, to build happy, productive lives, including going to college, where we excel. I realized I have done more than my share of mentoring, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young adults, where I have endeavored to help them. And, where what I know now that I wish I knew when I was 18 is what I've given to them. I realized I have pattern recognition on this now. And I know the 25 things that tend to come up. And I know what seems to be useful in addressing them and helping and drawing the young adult out to reach their own conclusions and make their own action plan and so forth. And I started by saying, I could write this down. I could do a kind of user's manual to your life. If you are Gen X or the lower end of millennial, say 18 to 30 years old, the kind of book that someone might want to give to a person that they care about when they graduate high school, or they go off to college, or they're in college, or they're graduating from college, or they're having a bit of difficulty in the workplace, or they don't seem to be able to find love, or they're confusing things. So I started getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I realized I'm never going to get this done if I don't, you know, do it methodically. So I got up for a year, 5 days a week at 5 a.m. and made myself write for an hour, usually half a chapter each day. And obviously I did rewrites and so forth. About 3 months in, I thought, there's another book that I could write, because I started thinking about anecdotes in my life, things that had happened to me as a film producer that are vivid in one way or another. And then another month or two into the writing process, where I was going A, B, A, B, alternate days I was writing the autobiography and alternate days I was writing the young adult self-help book, I realized this is crazy. If I collide them together, I can use things in my life to illustrate the chapter topics in the self-help book for young adults, which is precisely what I did. So as an example, there's a chapter where the chapter heading is, what is a good risk? What is a bad risk? How can you tell the difference? And I realized I've got it right and also got it wrong in all of those directions. And some of the stories are funny. Some of them are deeply scary. Some of them are just plain stupid. I mean, you know, I nearly died rescuing a kitten in a pipe duct, where I thought I was going to die in the pipe duct of a Moroccan hotel because no one would know that I was there, and the cat had run away. And I didn't have the upper body strength to get myself back up three floors to the exit from the pipe duct, things like that. But also risks that I'm so glad I took, because they didn't risk killing me. But if I had just sat there and not taken the risk, the analogy I used is, it's like sitting in an envelope and it's dark, and you have a pencil, and you could just sit there in the middle and come to no harm. Or the other thing you could do is you could poke with the pencil in a direction. You might poke the pencil through the envelope, in which case you'll know, in my case, I will never be a concert pianist, but you would be able to withdraw the pencil and then pivot a bit and try a different direction. And I think for a young adult, a lot of it is daring yourself to experiment, to work out what makes you happy.
And the thing I didn't say at the beginning, and I should have, is this book is aimed at a certain generation or age range, which is important, or demographic, because you want to impart what you've learned, mistakes and all, to a younger generation. And that's a significant part. Do you find, though, that it's the quandary we all face? Just because you get older and wiser doesn't necessarily mean that people younger than you will respect the fact that you've become wiser.
Well, let's recognize that this is the first time in history where, in several different ways, young people have the advantage over older people. It is the, as far as I know, and as far as I've been able to research, it is the first time in history where there are significant parts of human knowledge where young adults know more than older adults. When I lecture, if the overhead projector doesn't work, I don't stand up on the table and work out which plug has fallen out. Someone who's a student stands on the table and makes it work. The whole aspect of our modern lives, of interconnectivity, of access to all the knowledge in the world. You know, when I was a young adult, I went to a really fine university. It had a big library. I could read any book in that library. But what I couldn't do is what every single young adult can now do, which is to hyperlink. You're reading one text and then you hyperlink, and now you're reading a different text. You hyperlink to a third text. And this kind of, call it the exogenous brain, the anthill of human intelligence, the ability to access and pull from that, it's not only a huge, unprecedented asset, it's also a responsibility, a challenge, because if you don't apply critical thinking to it, you'll go down someone else's rabbit hole and think things that are just plain wrong, but you won't realize that. So what it means in encouraging young adults is that critical thinking turns out to be the most important thing that they will learn in high school and university, because they are bombarded with a lot of stuff, some of which is absolute rank nonsense. So they need to have the toolkit to be able to differentiate what is useful from what is not useful. But all of that said, what I had to do with the book, and I use these crazy anecdotes of working with mad actors over a life of making 2.5 dozen films all over the world, you have to make it vivid. So I see that the buying universe for the book, certainly Simon and Schuster think this, is adults who care about younger adults, whether it's parents or grandparents or Uncle Phil or Auntie Sheila, or it's a teacher or it's a lecturer. It's partly academic, but it's also partly social. And it is to do with, in this rather confusing world, you know, it's the old Chinese curse, isn't it? May you live in interesting times. I think many of us believe these times are a bit too interesting. It would be good if they could go back to steady state just a little bit. But I think for young people, I feel as though my pilot projects, my training ground, has been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of first star foster kids, young adults who are carrying PTSD, who come from abuse or neglect. Terrible, terrible things have been done from them. And now, what are they supposed to do? What is their future? How high can they possibly aim? They've been crushed down by, you know, legions of unhelpful adults. And now it's up to them. You know, we do this mad thing, don't we? Happy 18th birthday. You're out of here. You're an adult now. Go have a happy life. Send us a postcard. You know, the foster care system does that. It has defined itself, the organized foster care system, as this child is being abused or neglected. Remove them from that. Put them somewhere safe, or certainly safer. And then on their 18th birthday, send us a postcard. You know, make a good life. Let us know.
Yeah, it's a tough challenge. Tell us about Alex, who was in that First Star Academy at UCLA. Tell us a little bit about Alex.
Well, Alex is one of my favorite young adults, Alex Ballantyne, because I feel as though he is a really good example that it's dreadful to be a foster kid. But you do have one thing that you learn disproportionately well, and that's resilience. So there's Alex coming from a background that I won't talk about. It's not my privilege, but ends up in one of our First Star Academies and thrives there and goes through our 4 years, grades 9, 10, 11, and 12, and then fights his way into college. And, you know, we helped him a bit financially, and, you know, he's making a real go of it. And finally, he by the grace of God, he ends up in a foster placement with a wonderful family in a wonderful home. And I thought, oh, he's batting 1,000 and he's playing his trumpet and he's making music and he's doing the academic stuff. And he's coming back to teach the younger First Star students and so forth. And then the house burned down. And suddenly Alex literally had nothing but the clothes on his back. He and the foster family evacuated and not hurt. But everything in his life, all the physical stuff, burned to a cinder, including his trumpet. So he couldn't even make his music. So we then, and this is the glory of working through philanthropy, certainly in that case, we raised several thousand dollars and he got new clothes and he got a new trumpet, which I might say was donated. And he's back on track. Having said all of that, life is not only physical things, and he had to get his head back together. And in that, I think what Alex demonstrates that we can actually learn from foster kids is resilience. They knock you down, well, get back up, you know? You can do that and aim high. I think one of the greatest joys I have in my life is when I visit with the kids. I've got a whole Saturday coming up with our alumni at UCLA. I'm really looking forward to it because in them, I see what I think is my purpose on earth, which is helping young people to make the absolute most of themselves, be all that you can be. And it is invariably with foster kids who have been so crushed down. I can't tell you the awful stuff that I witness and that I learn that has gone on. I said to a kid recently, you seem to eat so much at lunch. Why are you always hungry? And he says, well, in the foster placement, you know, they lock the refrigerator. So I'm always hungry when I go to bed. And I said, they lock it? What do you mean they lock it? He said, there's a padlock on it. They had a padlock installed. And I said, well, who have the keys to the padlock? And he said, well, the whole of the fostering family. And I said, and have they got kids of their own? Yes, they do. You know, my age and younger than me, they all have keys as well. But I'm the one who goes to bed hungry. Or here's another one. We had the kids at one of our academies, just happenstance while I was there, they were all swimming in one of the big university Olympic-sized pools, having a fine old time. And I said to the director of our academy there, all the girls are wearing bikinis, but she's wearing a T-shirt. Why is that? To which the director said, oh, well, because she's got 100 cigarette burns all over her back, because that's how the birth mother punished her. You know, these are unimaginable things, but also my having been able for 25 years to learn from these kids has set me up, I think, to be able to write this book, which aims to be helpful every which way, divided by subject area, with points for reflection and questions at the end of each chapter. And you don't have to read it in order. I mean, in fact, I've started now saying to young adults, use the table of contents, look at what jumps out and bites you and says, hey, chapter here that could be really helpful. This is the stuff you've been worrying about. Go to that chapter first. Read it out of order. So I think it hangs together. I think it's already started making a very big difference to the young adults. I've actually just I'm donating the books to all of the current students and the alumni of First Star and a whole bunch of other young adults as well, because I think there's something there. And I've got the book tour coming up and I'm going to visit the academies of First Star and we're going to talk it up and I'll write something encouraging in the front of the books. So it's kind of a full circle for me. But there I sat in the recording booth in Burbank, all on my own, some with the engineer in the next room. And I basically read my life and what I've learned about how to be a successful young adult, pretty much by trial and error. I sat there for 18 hours over 3 days and just did it out loud, an unprecedented experience for me. I really enjoyed it. but it was also a cause for great introspection. And I kind of worked out, this is my life. This
is when you recorded, though, did you use that accent or a different one?
I used this accent. It's the only one God gave me. And I carried it with me, presumably because of cloth ears, across the Atlantic, and I still have it. I remember, as a young adult myself, I remember meeting a young lady, and I was jawing on about something, trying to be, you know, enticing and impressive. And at a certain point, she leaned in and she said, I have no idea what you are saying, but I just love your accent. So there you go. That cut me down.
I had to ask it. But how did you make the segue from the entertainment business to really finding fulfillment in philanthropy? I mean, not everybody. Yeah, there are some stars and producers and directors that get involved in charities in different ways. A lot of them are, it's part of the PR that they do. But you genuinely segued, not segued, because you continued your professional career too. But how did you make that transition? What kicked it off? Was there one episode or one incident?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And it's something that just hit me over the head or in the face, and that I had to do something about. I was introduced by my cousin to a dying 10-year-old little boy who was terminally ill in a hospital in London. And my cousin asked him, Sean, what would make you really happy? And Sean said, oh, that's easy. I want to go to Disneyland. And I remember her phoning me, the cousin, and saying, oh, I seem to have offered him a trip to Los Angeles. What are we going to do? And I said, well, I'll help. So we flew him and his mum to L.A. Everyone moved into my apartment, including the cousin. And we did, in 2 weeks, everything which you're probably not supposed to do with a very severely ill little boy. And everyone had a fine old time, certainly him, but also his mum. We realized we'd given her a great gift because this is how she would remember her kid at, you know, Knott's Berry Farm or Disneyland or on the beach or wherever. And he went home and he did pass away. And it was a real epiphany for me because I realized this wasn't even very difficult to do. I'm a film producer. I've done things much more difficult and complicated than bringing Sean to LA. So I called a meeting. I stood at the end of the table. I said, this is what we just did. Maybe a few times a year we could do it again. And that was the beginning of the Starlight Children's Foundation, which this year will help all around the world, 250,000 kids who are ill to be a modicum more happy, 8 psychosocial services, very active Starlight organizations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and the UK. So that was my first one. And what I realized by running it hands-on for 20 years was that the toolkit of being a film producer, which is based on pattern recognition. You know, a carpenter goes to a new job site. They've never built exactly what they're going to build in the past, but they've built a lot of stuff. They have the correct tools and they know that they can do it. And they just sort of hurl themselves into it. That is a film producer's toolkit, which transfers really well laterally across to repetitively addressing a major social need by just putting it together. It's like making a film. Who's my team? What's the business plan? Where's the money coming from? Who's distributing? Is it any good? Etc. So I've done that 7 times. There are 7 nonprofits, and they are, thank God, knocking on wood here, they are all thriving, and I did that. And when I look at my life as I did sitting in the recording booth, I think what I actually care about and what I take my, to use a bagel term, my nachas from, is that my children and grandchildren are healthy and doing fine, despite whatever mistakes I made in raising them. Secondly, that I've made, two dozen plus films, some at least of which have found a big audience and been appreciated. And that's how I've, made a career. And the third thing, and by no means the least, is the seven charities. Starlight makes seriously ill children happier, and their mums and dads and their siblings. Starbright, which I co-founded with Steven Spielberg, built the world's first social network with navigable avatars long before Second Life, long before Facebook. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg, when Steven and General Schwarzkopf and I pressed the big green button at Digital World in 1995 on Starbright World, Mark Zuckerberg was 11 years old, so we were there first. Of course, he was clever because he became obscenely rich, and we did ours as a charity, so more fool us. And then EDAR, Everyone Deserves a Roof. I hold the patent on a single user homeless shelter on wheels. Costs $800. Not as good as an apartment. Vastly better than a damp cardboard box on a rainy night.
There's a
And
picture of
on and
it.
on.
There's a picture of it in your book too, and so it's pretty impressive how you ended up doing that, meeting this homeless person, talking with her, and then you said, you know what, there's got to be something better
Well, she, I said, well, just backing up quickly, I was confronted coming out of a restaurant by a homeless guy who kind of with the hand upwards poking me in the chest. And I gave him money, and then I realized I was really angry with myself because he has nothing and was in rags, and I have a lot, and yet I was intimidated by him. What the heck is that? So when I find myself intimidated by something, I lean into it, and I actually went out on the weekends on my bicycle, and I did 65 interviews, and basically what I asked the unhoused people is, where do you sleep at night and how do you get money? And when I asked those questions to an old lady that I just met on the street, she said, I'll show you where I sleep at night. And she kind of pulled me by the sleeve onto the scrap of land next to the freeway. And in the bushes, there was a huge cardboard box. And she says, this is where I sleep at night. And it was disgusting. It was damp. And it smelled bad, and it had a piece of blue plastic over the top. But the thing that shook me to my soul was that on the side of her box that she lived in, it said Sub-Zero in big letters. And I thought, this is absurd. This is unacceptable. I got the refrigerator. She got the box. What is wrong with this picture? And we all know the golden rule. It's in 170 religions in the world, the sense of balance. Blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. The one I love is the Yoruba one in Nigeria. Before a man sticks a bird with a sharpened stick, he should stick it in his own eye and see how it feels. So, I do think there is social justice in the world. I do think we feel it in our heart. And I, very importantly in the book, I believe in the end of the end, how you make yourself happy is you have to help other people. Sure, you need to earn money. You need to have a roof over your head, etc. You need to find love. But in many ways, the overarching truth is that if you wish to be content in your place in the universe, you have to exert yourself. So, for example, in First Star with the foster kids, I teach a class. It's called Random Acts of Kindness and Pay It Forward. We talk about the golden rule. And then I say, thanks to a very generous donor in Texas, in Dallas, Mort, each of you are going to get $200. and 30 foster kids are agog. We're getting $200. And I say, no, you're not getting it to keep it. You have to write a 300-word essay to whom or to what you wish to give $200. You can give it to an individual. You can give it to a charity. Go for it. So these essays are amongst the most precious literature in my life. So a recent one, my name is Jose. I'm adding $10 of my own because that makes 210, and a third of 210 is 70. And down at the Humane Society, if you give them $70, they will agree not to euthanize one dog. And I am going to save three dogs. And the reason I'm going to do that is when I was down there the last time, I looked into the eyes of a puppy that had been very badly beaten, nearly to death. And I saw my own eyes because I was very badly beaten as well. So I'm saving three puppies, Jose. How about that? And the kids, we actually do this. We give the money, they go with, and then they have to go back a couple of weeks later and we see whether it worked. Because, you know, I say philanthropy doesn't always work. Did the guy buy the shoes or did he buy, you know, Ripple? So the kids, our kids, our first star kids, they grow, I think, about an inch and a half. Certainly their self-esteem, their sense of self-worth, their sense that actually theirs is not the woeful situation beyond any other in the universe. There are people worse off than them. Is a growth opportunity. It gives agency. And it's one of the best things that we do. And it's so counterintuitive. Also, when people are looking at First Star to donate, I think if you're a philanthropist and you realize that here's a philanthropy that teaches really woe-begotten kids who don't have two pennies to rub together, teaches them the joy of philanthropy, that speaks volumes. And it becomes actually quite emotional sometimes with potential donors and actual donors to First Star.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been filmmaker, philanthropist, Peter Samuelson. He's author of Finding Happy, A User's Guide to Your Life with Lessons from Mine. It's published by Regalo Press and distributed by Simon & Schuster and available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places.
And it's going into Target.
And for everything about Peter, go to samuelson.la. That's samuelson.la. Follow him on Facebook and X. And Peter, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.